still not enough. More and more of it. More and more of it. How can we tell if we have that love? Let me explain a little something here that every once in a while I feel I need to remind myself. I hope we're all reminded. Inshallah, you guys are already ahead of me, but I need to remind myself. Sometimes I may say Hussein, I use the word, but what I'm intending, the individual I'm intending, is an imaginary figure in my head. I have created a person and I've called that person Hussein, and I love that person in my mind. It's not the Hussein of Fatima. It's not the Hussein of the Prophet. It's not the Hussein. What's the sign? How can I tell if I actually love Imam al-Hussein? How can I? What's the sign of that love? This is very important. And again, I think if we think about this, we will see that this is not something that's being made up here. We have an abundance of hadith and verses also, one way or another, some of the verses allude to this as well. Love of Amirul Mu'mineen will pull and drag a person to be like Ali, to be closer to Ali, to do things that Ali would like you, to do things that Ali would like. A person who loves Ali ibn Abi Talib cannot stand being away from him. And if you want to be with him, you start looking for how can I be close to Ali ibn Abi Talib? How can I feel closer to him? I'll start looking for material. And then I'll find that it says, مَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ. If you want Ali to like you, Ali likes the muttaqin. He's Imamul Muttaqin. Who would like Ali ibn Abi Talib to take their hand? Who wouldn't, of you all, lovers of the Ahlbayt, who wouldn't like Ali ibn Abi Talib to take their hand and guide them? Ali ibn Abi Talib is Imamul Muttaqin, the Imam of those who are pious, who are implementing taqwa, who are careful of their deeds. You want Ali to like you? You want Ali to take your hand? Taqwa. Start doing more of that. This is an example. I'm not focusing on taqwa. Let's not lose the point here. The point is love of Ali ibn Abi Talib. But how can I tell that this is real love, and it's love of Ali ibn Abi Talib, not a person I've created, not a story I have created, not a big muscle macho man that is really good at war, but Ali ibn Abi Talib as he was? How do I know? This love should draw me to him, want to know more about him, want to be with him.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I saw Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're still talking about how you deal with yourself, how you are able to find life skills for the purpose of you becoming a better person individually, yourself. And therefore, in this book, Mafatihul Hayat, on chapter number 10, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli starts to discuss an important topic which we regularly do, and that is traveling. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Iftatih safaraka bis-sadaqah," that you should start your trip with Sadaqa, wa aqra ayat al-kursi, and recite ayat al-kursi. Start off your trip by reciting ayat al-kursi. Now, these are among the adab al-safar. So we've mentioned making sure that it's not a safar al-ma'asiyah, it's not a sinful trip, that it's not going to entail trip, that you're not making anyone upset by you traveling, you're not going behind anyone's back, you're not disobeying your parents, or you're not disobeying your husband, you're not leaving your wife, for example, all alone because you are angry over something. You know, these kind of trips are never going to end good, let alone entailing sin. How about when to travel? One hadith says that you should travel in the night time. One hadith says that you should never return back to your family in the night time. One hadith says, this is from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, "Man kana musafiran falyusafir yawm as-sabt." You should travel on a Wednesday. Another thing that you need to observe, that besides when to travel, is what to travel with, your zad, your supplies. And there are many hadith that speak about this zad, your supplies, your provisions that you are taking. Min sharaf al-rajul, from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, from the nobility of a man, ayyutayyiba zadahu, for them to be generous. A man should be generous when it comes to their supplies that they are taking, idha kharaja fi safarihi, when they're going onto a trip. Of course, here it's talking about generosity in the sense that you should make sure that you're traveling with good quality things. There was just a point that I wanted to mention, but just hesitated as far as that is concerned. But, you know, just remembering that a person shouldn't travel, you know how we mentioned that you shouldn't travel if it's going to entail sin. You should also not travel if you know that you are, for example, under debt and the person is demanding their money from you and things like that. You know, that's just it goes without saying, pretty much, you know. But because it's mentioned here, I just wanted to quickly mention that as well.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
Mafatih al-Jinan,
One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The hadith says that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would always travel with certain things. He would always travel with a brush. He would always travel with a mirror. He would always travel with nail clippers. You know, he would always travel with a siwak. These are things that he always traveled with. It's recommended when you do travel, before leaving, for you to bid people farewell. While you are traveling, before you come back, for you to buy gifts for your family members, which is also a sunnah. You know, here look, the hadith says, إِذَا خَرَجَ أَحَدُكُمْ إِلَىٰ سَفَرٍ فَلْيُوَدِّ إِخْوَانَهُ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ جَاعِلٌ لَهُ فِي دُعَائِهِمْ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will answer their prayers after this person has bid farewell to his friends before traveling. The whole sunnah of a person making sure that they are reciting the dua of bidding farewell and everything else. I'd just like to mention this interesting point where it says from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that you should remember that you bid people farewell, that you are very tolerant when it comes to traveling with other people, and also وَكَثْرَةُ الْمِزَاحِ فِي غَيْرِ مَا يُسْخِطْ Allah Azza wa Jal, and that when you are traveling, you should excessively joke as well and be humorous in things, of course, that does not entail sinning Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that which will bring about anger from Almighty God, which is an interesting point as well, you know, because, you know, usually when people are traveling, you know, they might be under a lot of stress or things like that, but there's this and numerous other ahadith that speak about how good it is for you to be humorous with those who are around you. Also, there's another thing that's important, and that is managing the group that you are with, because it's makruh to travel by yourself. So managing the group that you are with. Each person, before they leave, they all take out the expenses for that trip. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth heart, they will always be there. Be there.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
This is not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer, you see Reagan saying, "Make America great again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then, mm-hmm. and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without
generation. No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much like it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world. But reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious. ambitious, perhaps, but I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, and it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed, and we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So Neil, if I could bring you in here, there was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalised with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts, and this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show. And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation of being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? But he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, there are he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theatre that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage. You know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president. But actually, a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting. And we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War. By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks, the defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements. And internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learned that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics are drawing many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but and we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people. So we need to be quite careful. And that's, you know, that's the old word, really, for fake news in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that. And Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and actually with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become fake news, if you like. Lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, could I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how the, Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media-savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part in play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role at also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and it was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it shows that it got ramped up at this moment and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad. Edward Gibbon, 1737 to 1794, considered the greatest British historian of his time, in his book The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, says the following about Imam Ali. The zeal and virtue of Ali were never outstripped by any recent proselyte. He united the qualifications of a poet, a soldier, and a saint. His wisdom still breathes in a collection of moral and religious sayings, and every antagonist in the combats of the tongue or of the sword was subdued by his eloquence and valor. From the first hour of his mission to the last rites of his funeral, the apostle was never forsaken by a generous friend, whom he delighted to name his brother, his vicegerent, and the faithful Aaron of a second Moses. We
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali talks about living a simple life, eating simple food, wearing simple clothes. So Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, appointed a man from the tribe of Thaqif as governor of the city of Akbar. And so Imam Ali said to him, "Come to me tomorrow after the noon prayers. I have some business with you." This man, who was the governor, reports, "I went to see Imam Ali the next day, and contrary to what is usual with rulers, I didn't find any doorkeeper to stop me at the time of the appointment that I had. So I went in to see that Imam Ali was sitting, and with him was a clay bowl and a jug of water only." Allahu Akbar. We find here, dear friends, that Imam Ali alayhi salam at this point is the caliph of the Muslims. And we see that when we talk about humbleness and simplicity and talking about simple food and a simple lifestyle, we see that Imam Ali, despite being the most powerful person in the Muslim ummah, in the Muslim world, he didn't have some kind of doorkeeper to open the door or ring a bell to say that someone has come. And furthermore, he didn't have golden dishes or silverware fit for a king or a queen, as some of the later Muslim leaders did. Rather, we find that Imam Ali was sitting on the floor with a clay bowl and a jug of water. Truly, our leader, Imam Ali, the commander of the faithful, the commander of the believers, living such a simple lifestyle that we can all try to lead. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi talks about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Today, I would like to focus on one or two examples from non-Muslims who admire the sermons of Amir al-Mu'mineen, especially when it comes to Nahj al-Balagha. And we are talking about the non-Muslims of the present day. Let me start with one example from Christian Arab community. You know, Lebanon and Palestine has this Christian community from the Arabic background. They have been there from centuries, from before Islam, especially in Lebanon. And because they are culturally, ethnically Arab, for them, Arabic language is part of their life. And for them, even to learn Arabic literature, they study Quran as well as they study Nahj al-Balagha. And this is the reason why you see many of the Christian writers of Lebanon, you know, admire Ali, they adore his life and his sayings, and many of them ended up writing books about him. One of them is a person by the name of Suleiman Qahtani. Suleiman Qahtani wrote a book in the 60s. Actually, it was part of the competition, essay competition announced by the Hawza Ilmiya of Najaf in the 60s on Amir al-Mu'mineen. On the occasion, it was something to do with 1300th anniversary. And many, many submissions were sent to that committee in Hausa. It's amazing that the first prize went to not a Shia writer, not a Sunni writer. It went to Suleiman Qahtani, a Christian writer from Lebanon. And that book became very famous. Of course, he writing it from a Christian, non-Muslim background. You know, the committee did not always agree with all the statements, but they still considered it worthy to be placed as number one in the prize. And it was published with some editorial notes of the committee wherever, you know, statements might not be in totally in line with the Shi'i perspective. And his book, you know, fortunately also exists in English. And the title in English is Imam Ali, Source of Life, Wisdom, and Might.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of His messengers, and especially the last of them, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his progeny, and all of those companions of theirs who truly followed their path. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to another program of questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. You are listening IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, and today, fortunately, we have a guest scholar with us, Mr. Mohsin Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Mr. Naqvi, and welcome to our studios.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. The norm of this program is to answer important questions related to our Islamic beliefs through a fruitful and a healthy discussion. So without any further delay, let's move on to our question. Let's move on to the question today we have. Does religiosity means deprivation of pleasures?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is not. The simple answer is that. It's never been like that. And obviously, when we talk about these issues, first we need to talk about the basis of these questions. What do we mean by the pleasure itself?
Again, the definition is
very important. I think the last session we had, the modernism or something like that,
exactly.
Modern society. But today the question is about the pleasure. And the religiosity is not against the pleasure. Within the religion, there is a pleasure, but obviously there are the limits. First, we need to see, do we have anything in the world in which we are living, regardless of religion, which is without boundaries, which have no limits? There are always limitations on everything. For example, regardless, I'm not talking about the religion right now, regardless of religion, when we look at the society in which people are living, there is a constitution. There are some rules. The people are not allowed to steal things. They are not allowed to rob things. They're not allowed to hurt each other. They're not allowed to fight. They're not allowed to oppress, so-called like oppression, like the way we have justice. So there is a court, which there is a judge who is sitting there who judge between, or who basically makes the decision on the basis of evidences that are provided. And obviously there are the lawyers as well. Some of them are the lying lawyers and some are the true liars.
Yes.
So obviously it depends on which side they are, on the wrong side or the right side. So even in this world, without religion, we have all these things. Now my question is following the non-religious society a way to stop people from having pleasure? Because for some people, it's the way of stopping them from having pleasure. It's a limitation of their pleasure, on their pleasure. For example, a person who has a mental disorder, and we had these cases. Sorry to give this example on the obviously radio, but obviously the rape cases that have come, and the obviously people who were caught or arrested under this, we can say crime, most of them were having a mental disorderness, and because of their mental disorder, they were committing such thing.
Due to the pornography and...
Yes, due to anything. Yeah. It can be anything. Mm. But obviously, there was a mental disorder. For him, the pleasure was in that. But there is a rule. There is a police. There is a law and order to stop such a people. Now, is this a way to stop someone from having pleasure? For example, there are the series killers. The killers. Serial killers. There are the serial killers who kill people. When government, their law and order comes and stops them, is it because of, is it stopping or limiting the, obviously, pleasure that they had in that? There are some people who just like to tease people. You know, someone is walking on the street, they throw a stone on him, for example. Or you know the kids, what they do sometimes, you know, they're the bridges. And they go on top of bridges and they spit on the people who are walking below the bridge. It's a pleasure for him. And then if someone stops him, is it stopping? So basically, you need to define pleasure first. What do you mean by the pleasure? And does pleasure means that you should not have any kind of limitations in any kind of relation? In the limitations, even in the relationship that we have, like between a boy and a girl, there must be some limitations. If, I'm not talking about the religion right now, if we say, like, okay, the societies, they do not, for example, the non-Islamic or non-religious societies, they allow having a relation like boyfriend and girlfriend, for example. Being a boyfriend and girlfriend is also a limitation. Because when someone has a girlfriend, he cannot go to another girl. If he goes after another girl, the relation is broken. And then she becomes the ex-girlfriend, and this one is the current girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And same is the case with the boy. So there are the limitations everywhere in the life. When you see each and single, every single aspect of the life, if you see, you will find some limitations.
There are rules.
For example, a general rule, if a person drinks alcoholic drink, he goes to a bar, the owner of the bar, the government should allow him to drink as much as he wants. But there is a limitation. He has a limited money in his pocket. And he can drink up to the money that he has in his pocket. And when the money is finished, there is no drink for him. Now, why are you stopping him from having pleasure of drinking? Because he does not have money. So basically, there are limitations.
In some countries, there are laws that if you drink such and such amount of liquor, you cannot even drive.
So why you're stopping him?
Again, there is.
And there are other countries as well, like where people, if they waste food, I think it's Japan, China, or some of these countries, Korea. I don't remember which country is that. That if you order more than what you need,